Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Happy New Year and all the best for the year ahead. We're excited to be back with brand new shows, and this week we chat with Ariane de Bonvoisin about coping with change. She has some awesome advice about how to not only embrace change in your life, but make it work for you. We then speak with singer-songwriter Emily about being an indie artist and getting her music in film and television. We wrap things up with clinical sexologist Dr. René Langteau about sexual economics and what that means for women in this day and age.
Capture your need for sound.
Life has a way of throwing us curveballs, and often when we least expect it, learning to cope and adapt to these changes aren't always as quick and easy as we would like them to be. Today on the show, we welcome Ariane de Bonvoisin, who is the CEO and founder of First 30 Days, which helps guide people through all types of changes, both personal and professional. Ariane has lived in 6 different countries on 3 different continents, learned to speak 4 languages, and went to 5 different schools, all before the age of 18. She is no stranger to change and the anguish that can sometimes come along with it. Ariane, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be on.
At what point and why did you decide to create this platform to help guide people through their various situations?
So, Kelly, I had worked in the corporate world for about 10, 12 years, and I think like a lot of people, I wasn't very happy there. I knew I wasn't sort of doing what my soul wanted to do. I sort of felt like I'd climbed the wrong ladder. And as hard as it is to sort of leave a job, I sort of, you know, prayed and got down on my knees and asked for courage. And eventually I left that sort of image of a very external, perfect life. And the thing that was most missing for me was that I didn't really feel I was making a difference. I wasn't really feeling like what I was doing was adding any value or contribution. And I went off and I started traveling. And one of the things I realized was that actually every single person you meet is going through some sort of life change. They're either dealing with a tough change, you know, health diagnosis or divorce or a death in a family. They're either thinking about making a change, you know, they want to change careers, they want to, you know, have a child or pursue a dream, or they're helping someone else through a change. And then on the flip side, I always heard, you know, change is hard, I hate change, I never want to go through change again. And I thought, isn't it amazing that this change business is so hard, people, you know, avoid it, and yet it's the one constant guarantee in life. And none of us have ever really been taught how to get through it, how to navigate it. And I thought, you know, I've been through my fair share of changes, as you know. And I thought, well, why don't I interview a good 1,000 people or so and just get a sense of why is it that some people get through change and some people have such a hard time? Why is it that some people make those changes they always want and some people never do? And that's sort of the seed of the idea. I didn't know what it was going to become. The seed of the idea was there, and I ended up publishing a book where I detail these 9 principles of change that sort of bubbled up through these interviews. And then people were like, you need to do a website. And so on the website, first30days.com, there's 60 different life changes. So everything you could possibly imagine, from the first 30 days of a divorce, first 30 days of a baby, first 30 days of living spiritually, first 30 days of starting a business. And I sort of went and found experts and other people who'd been through those changes. So it was really, it was a dream to sort of make a difference and also go with something that I loved. I love people. I love change. I love, you know, I wanted to sort of help people have their lives turn out differently.
Why do you think it's so hard for us to sometimes accept, you know, that change is coming or that it's actually already here? I find some people just super dig in their heels.
Yeah, I think all of us at some levels, because we're all human beings, I think we're wired for certainty. I think we're wired to be in control. We're wired to do whatever it makes us feel safe. And change doesn't go with any of those things. So change really threatens all of those. I think we prefer to find our confidence in our home and our job and our partner and our kids and our money. And then beyond that, we don't really want anything to change. And a lot of us actually prefer the familiar, even though we might be suffering tremendously in a job we hate, in a relationship that's not right, because change appears to bring up so much anguish because it does mean the unknown, a lot of us dig in our heels. And I think what change shows us is that, you know, we're not in control and that there is this thing called life, which is going to bring people in our life and take things away and bring work and often take it away as well. So change sort of digs into our core identity, which is I just want to be safe. and just want to be safe often means I don't really want anything too much to change, because what we don't know at the time when we're going through change is that change actually usually also brings good things. But we've been wired to think that, you know, change is bad.
Have you noticed that, you know, it feels like sometimes people think when they're going through a change, like they're the only one that this is, you know, happening to, and it's very frustrating, and I guess they feel very isolated. How can people try to get themselves out of that mentality?
Well, I think, you know, when we're going through a change, what it often does is it rocks our confidence. It you know, our self-esteem comes tumbling down. You know, if we got fired or dumped or whatever it is, put on weight, can't quit smoking. And I think a lot of change, you know, sometimes brings an introversion, like you want to go inside. You don't really want to reach out for help. You don't really want to share your change with other people. You go into, you know, the classic, I'm alone. No one has ever felt this bad. No one has ever cried so much on the couch. No one has ever eaten so much ice cream. And we sort of disconnect from realizing that actually everyone has gone through so many similar changes. It's just we keep them so close to our vest in some ways. And I think, you know, this is definitely one of the principles, the 9 principles of change, is people who are good at change, you know, they're not alone. They have a change support team. They do reach out. And there is a time for being alone, and there is a time for sort of going inwards. But everyone I met got through a change because someone else was there for them. And the interesting thing is very often it's not the people you think. It's not your family. You know, sometimes your family are just as rocked as you are because of your change. Sometimes it's brand new people that come into your life while you're going through a change who don't have a sense of who you are or who you were or what you used to be. And they very often sort of can help you see yourself differently, because, you know, you don't dig in your heels and go, well, I am this person. This is my identity. So I always find life provides sort of new people, people who are there to listen, people who do want you to get through a change. And I think it's just a matter of, you know, letting people in. We all know how good it feels when we're helping someone else. And so it's just letting people be there for us as well. There's always someone around.
How can people try to find motivation to make or create that change that occasionally, you know, they desperately want? Like sometimes people actually, you know, they might be scared of it, but they need it or want it to happen.
Yeah, I mean, motivation is probably sort of the big question. Again, what I've found through my research and just all the talks I've given and being around so many people now who are going through changes, most people get stuck on motivation because of, you know, not really knowing why they want to change. They're kind of in this sort of no man's land. They're kind of in this like, well, it's not that bad. You know, the relationship, it's not that bad. And the weight, it's not that bad. And this job, it's not that bad. And so there's not a very strong reason why. And what I found is the people who really get through a change, they're very clear on their why. Why they need to stop smoking. Why they need to lose weight. Why they need to, you know, take some time off work and be with their family. So the first thing I would say is if you really are looking for motivation, ask yourself, well, why, and then whatever the change is about. And sort of really dig in and sort of have that be, you know, something that is really important. You know, why is it that women lose weight before their wedding? Because they've got a really strong reason why. Why do people stop smoking when they're pregnant? They have a really strong reason why. And before that, there's nothing that would have done it. So that's sort of one thing. And the other motivation, again, to come back to what we spoke in the previous question, is involve people, involve your friends. Like, you know, have them hold you accountable, verbalize the change you want to make, let them get in your face, let them motivate you, let them encourage you, let them check in with you, let them put a deadline on you in case you don't get through your change. But it's way too easy to sort of make a little commitment to yourself in your head or in your journal and then, you know, hide it from the world. And, well, it's not so bad if you don't get it. So the more, you know, involve your colleagues, involve your family who's really going to kick your bum, and just sort of, you know, let people sort of want the change with you. You know, it's one of the biggest things I could probably say is, well, who's around you? Who wants you to change?
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Ariane de Beauvoisin, author of The First 30 Days, Your Guide to Making Any Change Easier. Make sure to check out her website, first30days.com. Ariane, I actually want to talk about, you know, this 30 days, because obviously it's, you know, a title in your book. It's also a part of the title of your website. So how important is this first 30 days?
Well, I I think it's incredibly important. I think everything actually gets decided in the first 30 days. If you look at the changes people want to make, so that, you know, there's two categories, the changes you initiate and the changes sort of life throws at you. If you look at the changes you initiate, so many people quit before the first 30 days. You know, you think about New Year's is up around the corner. Most people's resolutions, they don't even get to sort of halfway. It's sort of in the first 30 days that everything from your beliefs, your motivation, your courage, your faith, you know, all of that stuff gets tested. And sort of your discipline, sort of, it's either there or it's not there. You know, why you choose to go for this change. I mean, not to get, you know, scientific and psychological, but there's plenty of studies that show it takes 28 to 30 days for the brain, the actual neocortex in the brain, to get comfortable with a new habit. Something has changed. It's not in the first week the brain's going to go, this is kind of new and fun and interesting. But it's only when you start getting up to 28 to 30 days that the brain actually settles into a new groove or a new habit. I think also when, you know, the other category of change where life throws something at you, it's in the first 30 days that you are going to make up your mind about what this means. Is life against you? Are you unlucky? Are you a victim? Are you a martyr? Did bad things happen to you? So the story you attach right from the beginning is actually the story you're going to start living into. The beliefs that you have about, well, what does this change actually mean, you know, are going to be very self-evident when you get into the first 30 days. If you resist the change, it's going to be the strongest in the first 30 days. You know, most people who are good at change, they get to a point of accepting that this change has happened. So you get back into sort of the flow. So the first 8 days is as much of a metaphor of actually just getting started in the right way. It's sort of which direction are you pointed in? And it's also, you know, an ability to let the physical body, the emotional body, even the spiritual body just catch up with the change that you're either intending or the change that life is actually wanting you to look at now.
Do you find older people have a harder time at change? And I'm not talking about necessarily, you know, people in 70s or 80s. I think we all know that sometimes they're very set in their routine. But it's interesting how sometimes I think people in their 20s are better at change, you know, but then sometimes I think when you're in your 30s, you understand what was going on. So you might be more accepting of change then as well.
Yep. Again, I would say it's a little bit of both. I would be able to say it sort of categorically. I think as we get older, we do, you know, we realize we've got a change resume. We've been through a fair share of changes. And we realize that, you know, life is sort of part of this. We're not just the only ones that's going to be in control. So we can sort of not only relax into life sort of throwing things our way, but we also sort of know what we're made of. You know, I talk about this concept of the change muscle. And the change muscle does get stronger over time because you're building up these references and this database inside of you of, you know, I'm the girl that got through this, or I'm the guy that witnessed this and had to initiate this and get this done. So that change muscle does get stronger over time. What I have found also on the flip side is the older we get, the more excuses we tend to also sometimes have. You know, I'm too old, or I'm not qualified, or I didn't have an education in this, or it's going to take time. You know, this change, it's not in my nature. So it sort of goes both ways. It's sort of, you know, when we're younger, sometimes we have a lot less excuses. When we're older, sometimes we can actually just sort of go, you know what, I'm going to do this anyway. So it sort of goes differently with different people.
It's kind of fascinating. And I just wanted to bring this up. For example, my mother, who my listeners know as Mummy Alexander, she hates the internet. Like she, you know, she does use a computer for work. But that's like a financial-based program, and it's very set, and that's the way it is. And for years, I've tried to get her, you know, into, like, exploring, because she likes to cook. I'm like, Mom, there's tons of recipes there that you can check out, like, all this kind of stuff. But she just does not like it. Like, she'd rather be outside if she has any free time. Anyways, lo and behold, about a month ago, she decides that she wants to now really be proactive about learning how to navigate the internet and like learning how to email properly and like all this kind of stuff. And it's funny how I think part of it is because she doesn't want to be left behind because she sees her grandkids that are, you know, on fire and 6 years old. And also I think it's also because we got her an iPad and it seems much easier for her. Like she's not, you know, having to, you know, there's apps, it's much easier to navigate, but it's weird how this shift in her mind has just opened her up to all these different experiences.
Well, do you know, the point that you bring up there for me is that people will do more for other people than they will for themselves. So, for example, she'll do it for her grandkids. She'll do it to stay connected to you. She'll do it to be part of something else. You know, I did the same thing. I gave my mother an iPad. She's now on Skype and kids. And it's sometimes we will change for others much more than we'll just sort of do it for ourselves.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this. What happens when a person really wants to make a change and, you know, is ready to take that leap, but might be unable to do it at that particular time because of, you know, financial reasons or maybe family responsibilities? How would you guide them to continue reaching for that specific, you know, goal of change when it could be several months or maybe even years away?
Sure. And I would say, you know, one of the biggest myths is that we think change happens instantly and quickly and in a few days or a few weeks. People who are good at change have a much longer sort of runway to actually get a change. If there are people who get their New Year's resolutions, they give themselves 3 months, 6 months, even a year. And if you see it that way, things actually, you know, manifest that way. What I would say to your question is, what I've found is the most important changes we make in our life are actually, they're not dependent on financial or family or career or age or anything. The most important changes we make are internal changes. What do I mean by internal changes? There's things like your self-esteem, your beliefs, your energy, your faith, your enthusiasm, your courage, your discipline, decreasing your disapproval, your negative voice inside yourself, how you see yourself. So all change is internal. I know it appears like they're external changes, but all changes is about how you see yourself internally. And for people who, you know, have financial issues or can't particularly get up and walk and, you know, they want to sort of maintain all of their financial and family responsibilities, I would say you can start right now doing some of that inner work. Catch your disapproval, you know, catch how many times you beat yourself up, catch when you compare yourself, catch the excuses that come up. Start looking at your beliefs around starting a business or around money and is making money hard. All of that is available to anyone. It doesn't depend on anything outside, because all change is identity change. You know, it's how and who I am being in the world. And a lot of times people think, oh my God, this change is taking so long, and it's because their inner hasn't shifted. And when the inside shifts, the external shifts very quickly. So for people who have stuff going on, start doing the inner work, journal, do sort of really some personal development. And then when you are ready to jump, you'll be amazed how quickly the external is going to follow.
What's your most important thought, I guess, or piece of advice, you know, for people when they are going through a major life change?
You know, I'm going to sound repetitive, but you've got to get around other people, you know, whether it's a positive life change, you know, which we forget about. You know, we always think change is always the negative stuff, but the most wonderful things that have ever happened in your life have also happened because something has changed. And so change gets a bad rap because we always just remember the really tough ones. But I would say definitely get around other people. And then the other thing I found with people who really are going through tough life changes is, you know, the energy is very directed to you. It's, you know, you've lost your job or you have this issue going on or you know, it's very me driven. And I think one of the things that is best to sort of get back into the flow and back into being connected with life and others is to just do anything for someone else. Even if it's just, you know, a small thing, I'm not talking about volunteering, but just to realize that, you know, there's a world out there and there are other people. And, you know, you are still a mother, a sister, a daughter, a best friend. You are still working. To sort of broaden out, you know, your perspective of what actually might have happened to you. So to me, it's a combination of both. You know, get back into being connected. Go, you know, help out in any particular way that you can. Who else needs my help right now? And sort of get around other people.
I think that, you know, people, as you go through life, you meet other people and all that sort of stuff, and you realize that some people seem to be better at change than others. In your experience of interviewing all these types of different people, have you noticed a characteristic trait that separates someone who is easily adaptable to change versus someone who sort of, you know, puts their feet in the cement and is like, no, I'm not doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the very first and second principle of change in the book. And, you know, all the experts on the website would agree. People who are good at change are optimistic. People who are good at change have positive beliefs. They believe, you know, life is on their side. Even though I don't like what's happening, life is conspiring for my good. You know, they believe in what I call the change guarantee. The change guarantee is, from this change, something good will come. You don't know when, you don't know what it looks like or in what form, but when you can plug your mind into actually going in that direction, it's amazing how quickly the gift and what is positive about this change that might have been incredibly difficult reveals itself. And so, you know, the number one thing when I coach people, when I speak to people, my antenna go up and I start listening to their language, their beliefs, what they think about themselves, what they think about life, what they think about other people. And I can tell, are they a change optimist or are they a change pessimist? You know, I teach this to kids. Kids get it immediately. You know, it's like, what is it that you're focusing on? Because what you're focusing on, the negative of the change, believe it or not, expands. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So that's the character trait. If there's one, it's sort of, it's catching the negativity. You know, we all have it to some level, but it's catching it, choosing, and reaching for a more positive thought.
Fantastic. That's amazing. And where can people get a copy of your book?
So the book is available on Amazon, any major bookstores, and of course off the website as well, so first30days.com. It's available as an ebook. There's a couple other books there that I've written that you guys can go find out. It's available in French right now in Canada, so any French speakers as well.
Awesome. Ariane, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Kelly. It was a real pleasure.
That was Ariane de Bonvoisin. Again, for more information or tips or any of that sort of good stuff, make sure to check it out on her website, first30days.com.
Capture your need for sound.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is singer-songwriter Emma Lee, who has been creating a buzz not only in national newspapers, but in fame magazines like Chatelaine and Fashion. Emma Lee's latest album is called Backseat Heroine and can be described as a little bit country as well as a little bit rock and roll. We're very excited to have her join us today. Emma Lee, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can you tell us about how you got your start in the music industry, and has it been, you know, a lifelong goal for you?
Yeah, I think singing has always been a part of my life, and I was raised in a pretty musical family. Both my parents were musicians, and just raised us listening to music all the time. Like, we're the type of family where there'd be music playing in the house, in the car. Like, it'd be weird if there wasn't music playing. And I think that was just always a part of me, and it wasn't until maybe my late teens, early 20s that I really started writing my own songs. And and when I moved to Toronto, I grew up in Markham, which is just outside of Toronto. And when I moved to Toronto was when I discovered things like open mics and kind of realized a bit more of this possibility of being an indie artist. And I just got really fascinated with the idea of doing everything myself. And I got pretty hooked on it and pretty into it, and just started, you know, making demos and recordings and putting a band together. And I was really hands-on, and I still am to this day.
Were your family and friends very supportive of you doing this? Like, I know that you said your parents are musicians, but obviously it is a struggle.
Yeah, no, they really were, actually, like, probably more so than a lot of parents might be. But I think both of my parents, you know, in their youth wanted to do what I'm doing now. And so I think there was just a lot of excitement for them, you know, watching me grow through the years and make this into an actual career for myself. It's definitely, you know, not for the faint of heart. You need nerves of steel to make it in this business. And I think it's just been kind of fun for them to take that journey.
What do you say to someone who wants to do what you're doing right now? Is the biggest tip to basically believe in yourself, or obviously, like you said, have a nerves of steel?
I think it's a combination of believing in yourself, you know, in spite of what people say about you, because you're always going to come up against people who think that what you do isn't great. And if you really believe in yourself, you can, you know, reach the people that do think what you're doing is cool. But the other thing is to just really, really focus on your talent. And if you're a songwriter, to focus on writing great songs, because at the end of the day, you can be the most well-connected person in the world or have all the money to, you know, make your own music videos or whatever it is. But if you don't have great songs and a great voice, and if you can't perform them well, then you are going to, you know, kind of eventually fade away, and people won't, you know, support you anymore. So just focus on songwriting and your voice and your talent as a musician.
Joining us on the show is singer and songwriter Emma Lee. Make sure to check out her website, emma-lee.com, and also on Twitter, at Emma Dashley, and Dash is spelled out. Do you have a sound that you actually strive for in your songs, or do you see where the universe sort of takes you as you're writing?
I think it really varies from song to song. Each one is like, you know, its own little world, and you kind of find the sounds that most suit it. You know, whether that's supporting it with a lot of instruments or whether it needs to be stripped down to something so simple and bare because that's the strongest way that it can come across. I don't think I go into a song with the sound in mind, and that kind of happens later, but just get the essence of the song first.
Can you tell us about your latest album, Backseat Heroin, as well as what you want your fans to take away from it?
Well, Backseat Heroin is actually, it was a lyric that I took from a Bobby Gentry song. Bobby Gentry was this singer-songwriter from the 70s who I really loved. And I ended up having that lyric in mind when I did a writing session with an artist named Nicole Atkins, who's out of Brooklyn in the States. And we got together, and I had some little snippets of ideas and that song title, and she really liked it. And we ended up writing that song. And I guess that song in particular just sounded the most like an album title. And there was something, you know, Backseat Heroin, it sounds kind of heroic and strong, I guess you could say. And that was just part of the theme of the album was, you know, strength. And
do you enjoy collaborating with other people, or do you find most of the time you're quite happy to write your songs by yourself?
I like both. I think that writing songs with people, first of all, you really learn a lot from other people, and in the process, you take away, you know, little tricks that you may not have had in your bag before you met that person. And collaborating can also just, you know, help the song move faster, or it can, you know, take you to places that you would never go on your own. But then, you know, by yourself, I think there's also something to be said for writing a song completely alone, because that's when you're able to access like your deep, deep, deep subconscious. That's kind of a hard place to get when you're in a room with another person.
Do you have a place?
But I love it.
Do you have a place where you like to write, or can you be all over? Like, can you actually be on the road? Because I've interviewed a few artists where it's weird. It's almost like split down the middle, where some will say they get super inspired when they're on the road and they're happy to do it, even though they've got, you know, X amount of things to do and they're playing, you know, a certain set or certain set of songs. And then I've had other artists that tell me that they really need to focus on what they're doing, and they may pull ideas or they may store away ideas, but they can't even touch it until they're back home.
I think I might fall in the latter category. I definitely get inspired when I'm on the road, but unless I have like a really big window of time, it is tough to kind of like sit there and get those ideas, you know, tuned into an actual song. Sometimes for me, like my brain just works in a way where I need that kind of separation. Like, I'm on the road and what I'm doing is performing these other songs I've written, versus when I'm home and I can say to myself, okay, I'm allowed to be creative now. I'm allowed to take the time to start writing something else.
Okay. And do you have, you know, an artist in mind or a group in mind that you would actually really love to collaborate with?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people. One of my all-time favorites is an artist named M. Ward, who's also a producer and songwriter. And he's from the States, but he's probably up there on my top list of people I would like to collaborate with someday.
Awesome. And how do you feel being, you know, sort of described as a singer-songwriter? And like you said yourself, you know, you're quite happy to be in that indie realm. Do you find that there's ever a stigma being in that realm? Or do you almost think it's more creative and the people looking in are like, wow, that's cool, she's a singer-songwriter from the indie scene?
Yeah, I don't feel like there's a stigma associated with that. I guess I am a singer-songwriter, so I don't really know what else to call myself. I find that's actually the easiest way to describe what I do, because I work in so many different genres. And when I think of like singer-songwriters, you know, from like the 60s and 70s, I kind of feel like they're, when you say the word singer-songwriter, you think of someone who can, you know, cross through many different genres in their singing and their writing. So yeah, I totally am that.
Does it ever bother you, or I don't know if bother is the right word, but how do you feel when you see more mainstream acts, you know, who might not have a clue how to write a song,
you know, get to where they're getting to based on either, I mean, obviously they have to put in some sort of work, that's for sure, we all can agree on that, but does it bother you whether it's a mainstream actor, even someone else who just sort of gets up there and sings? Like, do you really appreciate when someone can actually say, hey, I wrote this song?
You know what? I think I can respect both camps, because I think it also takes a lot of courage to just know your strengths. And I do a lot of songwriting for people and with people who aren't strong songwriters or who don't ever write songs by themselves. And so when you know that you're an incredible singer, but that maybe you're more of a song interpreter, and that you don't really have something that you want to say, or that you don't know how to put into words what it is you'd want to say, I think it takes courage to actually know that about yourself and say, I'm a singer and I'm going to sing other people's songs and I'm fine with that. So I have no issues with people who choose great songs to sing. It's more if they don't write it and it's a bad song. Then I'm not down with it.
And do you look up to people like, you know, a Diane Warren, who has made a career out of writing songs for other people and is always
absolutely
in the background?
Okay. Absolutely. I think that's the coolest.
Awesome.
I would love to write for, you know, Aerosmith.
I think a lot of people would, that's for sure. Joining us on the show is singer-songwriter Emma Lee. Again, make sure to check out her website, emma-lee.com. Also on Twitter, @emma-lee. And again, dash is written out. So this is something really cool, and I'm very excited to ask you about this. I heard that one of your songs was actually entitled Tyler Perry's movie, Why Did I Get Married Too? Not to mention being in TV shows like HBO's Bloodletting and Miraculous Cures. How did that happen, and what does it feel like to know that your music is making it onto TV and film?
Oh, it's been so great. I feel like I've really been lucky in the placements department, and it's really exposed my music to a bigger audience in a fast time. I mean, one placement can often be worth, you know, a whole tour, which, you know, takes you weeks and, you know, it has all kinds of expenses associated with it, versus one TV show spot that you land and, you know, 5 million people hear your song in one night, which can be really, really amazing. How it happened is, you know, there are people out there who work, you know, artists' song catalogs to try to help them get into film and television. And I've done various showcases to music supervisors who work in film and TV. And it's just, you know, you just keep at it, keep sending your music to people, and eventually the right spot comes up for your song.
That's fantastic. Well, congratulations on that. I think that's amazing, especially with regards to Tyler, because we all know, you know, how much noise he's made in the last couple of years, and so many people go to see his movie. So that's fantastic. And what's up next for you, Emma Lee, like in the next 12 to 18 months? Because I know, like before, you know, I would have asked you what's coming up in the next 5 years, but now everything is so different, and it's almost like you have to go in year increments or even less.
Well, I'm just on the road right now. And then the new year, I'm planning to do a little bit more touring for this album within Canada, and as well, we're just working out a deal with a label in Germany, so we may be taking this album over to Europe to do some touring, and then after that I'll start writing my third album.
Fantastic. And do you expect to, you know, keep, because I we just talked about it a little bit before, I keep mentioning, you know, your website and your Twitter handle, and obviously you're on the social media. Do you think that it's really important for you as an indie artist to keep growing those social media fans to help push your career forward?
Oh, absolutely. That's such an integral part of being an indie artist at this point, and staying connected to your fans, because as we all know, people are just, you know, constantly having things thrown at them, music, television, movies, all these different things. And once you make that initial connection with a fan, you need to kind of work to maintain it so that they don't forget about you, because honestly, there's just a million different artists and songs coming out every day, and you need to have that, you know, personal touch, I guess you could say, to keep people active and coming to your shows and supporting you, and yeah, all that. It's really important.
So Emily, can you tell us where people can actually get a copy of your album, A Backseat Heroine?
It's available at your local HMV or online on iTunes or anywhere, Amazon, anything online. And you can also order it directly off of my website.
Fantastic. And we have a lot of people that are listening now, you know, overseas. We've got people in Australia listening, Japan, as well as our Canadian and American friends. How do you feel when you are traveling around? You know, do you notice a big difference in cultures? And do you appreciate sort of traveling and seeing these different cultures and maybe taking them into your work?
Yeah, definitely. I haven't gone very, very far outside of North America, but I did do a little bit of touring earlier this year, and I got to perform in Cannes, France, and in London. And I think that people were just super appreciative there. I mean, definitely have an open mind about music in general in Europe, and in the States as well. Like I think you just have to find the right venue for what you do, and the people that kind of go to those clubs will be the right audience for you, just depending on who you are and what kind of music you make. And I definitely make an effort to find those places and find my audience within those places.
Emily, well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it, and we wish you all the best of luck.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for doing this interview.
That's singer and songwriter Emily. Again, make sure to check out her album, Backseat Heroin. You can also check her out on her website, emma-lee.com, and also on Twitter, @emma-lee.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
The National Hockey League is back. The $3.3 billion North American industry, which employs not only millionaire athletes, but check-to-check front office folk and small business owners surrounding the NHL's 30 rinks, is back in business. The three-month lockout is over. Once the CBA is officially ratified this week, training camp will start later this week and the regular season about a week after that.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton returned to work after her hospitalization for a blood clot in her brain, near her brain. And before that, of course, for falling and suffering a concussion. Well, today her staff greeted her with a standing ovation and a funny gift. Look, a football helmet with the State Department seal and a jersey with the number 112. That's how many countries she has visited, the most traveled Secretary of State in history.
According to researchers at the National Institute of Health, folks who drink four or more cans of diet soda a day are 31% more likely to be clinically depressed than those who don't drink diet soda at all. Those who drink regular soda are not immune. They are said to be 22% more likely to be depressed than non-soda drinkers. But it was even worse for folks who drink diet fruit drinks. They are 51% more likely to be depressed. It's important to note that this does not mean that the drinks cause the depression, because there's also evidence that folks who are depressed crave sweet drinks. So chicken or the egg?
A New York City ferry boat packed with hundreds of rush hour commuters came in for such a hard landing this morning. It slammed into the dock, hurled passengers through the air, down staircases, into windows. At least 70 people were injured. An investigation is underway.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
My question for you today is, what price tag do you put on sex? The fact is that we all put a price tag on sex, but typically each person gives something different. Today on the show, clinical sexologist Dr. René Lacteau joins us to talk about today's sexual economics and what that means for both men and women. Dr. René, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me.
There seems to be such a huge culture of, you know, hookups and one-night stands going on today, I guess, versus back a few generations ago, where that either didn't seem to happen as much or those things were kept very quiet. Why do you think sex today is so easy to come by for men?
There's a lot of factors that should be discussed in here. Actually, if you look 60 years ago, women did not go to university as much as they attend now. So the percentage of female attendance in university were quite low. So if you're comparing, a lot of the studies that people are looking at when they look at sexual revolutions, they mostly look at what's happening on universities and the campuses, which is kind of a not fair comparison if you're going to put as much value on the results. Mostly value, when I'm talking about it, is how you're going to socially dissect the information that you get.
Do we as women really put a price tag on sex? And I guess, can you explain, you know, how we do that if that's the case?
Yeah, I think if you look at sexual activity throughout a woman's lifespan, we do go through a price tag. You're not going to just go out and have sexual intercourse with anybody that you're going to find out. What I'm finding is a difference now compared to 60 years ago is that when you meet somebody, before it was you were afraid of getting pregnant, so you would have long-term repercussions. So now that people are taking the contraceptive pill and that you have more access to contraception, women actually enter into sexual relationships more freely and for themselves. So it's a lot more sexual freedom that women have. But having said that, they don't go out and sleep with just anybody. They want to get something out of it. It can be superficial, but the guy is going to have to be a certain look. He's going to have to make her feel a certain way before she just agrees to go back to his place and have sex with that partner.
Do you think in this generation that women have an increase in sexual power, I guess if you want to call it that, or high economics, because they're more empowered than they might have been, like, you know, 30 or 40 or 50, 60 years ago?
You know, when I was reading the article, I didn't like that it was that they looked at the economics so closely. I found that it was kind of, you know, when you look at just a part of the entire equation, you miss out some of the elements that are surrounding it. I just thought that women now have a lot more sexual powers for themselves. Before, they used to have sex, but they were brought up as being good girls. Religion was very important back then. So when a woman would give in and have sexual intercourse with a partner, they wanted a long-term relationship. They wanted to have the ring on their finger. Right now, women don't want to get married as early as they do, and people get married a lot less. If you look at statistics, there's the people that are common law are increasing. You didn't have any common law 60 years ago. So when you look now, you have 67% of Canadians that get married versus 92% in the 60s, which is a massive difference. So I find that the sexuality that women have is bigger in terms of they have sex because they want to have sex, and they want sex because it gives them pleasure, as opposed to before when they had sex because they wanted to get the guy and get the ring. So it's a little bit different. I find that the economics that they're describing in the article was very different. They didn't look at the underlying kind of connotations that go behind it, why women have sex, basically.
When you look at the advent of birth control, I know you briefly touched on it before, but did this really bring about a sexual freedom for women since its inception?
Yes, definitely. So women now, they don't have to fear to get pregnant. They can basically, you know, it's a no-brainer. Before, you would say, okay, stop there or pull out, and we all know that the pulling out method is not a very good one in terms of contraception. Women now can stop thinking about the fear of having sex, and they can start having sexual intercourse and focus on the positive feelings it brings to their body. Of course, you need to wear protection. It's important to protect yourself against sexually transmitted infections. But in terms of taking the pill, at least it's one thing that they know they're protecting themselves against.
Joining us on the show is clinical sexologist Dr. Renee Langteau. Make sure to check her out on her website, drsexology.com. Do you think that women are potentially more open to sexual hookups, quote unquote, in this day and age because they are actually getting further ahead in life with regards to their career and maybe rights for women, stuff like that?
What I'm noticing is that women have sex now not to get married to somebody that has the money. They go to university. They have careers. They are part of, most of the time, half of what the income is in the household. They do more than half of their share in the household, in the chores. They take care of children. Women are truly super women right now. Unfortunately, men are not always pulling their weight on that front They stay eternal teenagers for longer. They don't move out of their parents' house anytime soon. Women seem to be a lot more mature earlier than guys on that front. So, yeah, I find that the fact that you have money in your wallet makes you more independent to not staying into a relationship. Like, you have the freedom to walk out. You're not tied down because you don't have a bank account. You don't have the fear of being homeless anymore. Just like 60 years ago, if your relationship was not working out, you would still stay married because you did not have access to your own money. So walking out was quite expensive.
Now, when it comes to rules of engagement regarding sex, is there a huge difference between men and women?
Can you clarify your question in terms of rules of engagement?
Yeah, like I guess just how, you know, a man versus a woman is going to approach, you know, how they engage in their sexual behavior, like with these easy hookups.
Yeah, the easy hookups, I guess everybody has their own perfect scenario that is going to push you. And, you know, like if all of the elements are there, you're going to say yes to it. Men usually, and I say usually because not everybody applies to you're a man, it's easier for you to say yes, and you're a woman, it's easier for you to say no. But how many women go with their friends now to Vegas and they paint the town red, like they just go crazy and they come back home and they still have their partners, but you don't really know what happened over there. So in terms of sexual freedom, women are actually reaching or getting way closer to what men used to do on a normal basis. So I think that men, you know, like always, if the opportunity is there and if the person is close enough, there most of them will jump in the sack. Whereas for women, I think they're giving themselves more permission. Also, life on campuses at universities, you have a lot more stories of threesomes, of women trying out with other women. So women are not staying in their little cocoon where they have to be good girls or else they're not going to be, their value is going to decrease. If you look at a woman saying, oh yeah, I've tried this, I've tried having sex with another woman, it was fun, it's not for me, but it was fun. She actually is trying to discover what her boundaries are, what her limits, and, you know, if it's for her. So she doesn't let somebody else impose her own their own taste on upon her. So I like that women are exploring their choices a lot more than they used to be.
In the article that both you and I read about, you know, sexual economics, there was a section where it talked about how women apparently lose their sexual value once they pass the age of 30, meaning that, you know, when they're in their 30s, there's, I guess, more women who are not married. And if they're trying to get married, you know, there's less men and less opportunity and all that sort of stuff. That was the gist that I got out of it. Do you really believe that women lose sexual value once they get into their 30s? And do men ever lose sexual value? Because it sounds like everything's just peachy keen for them.
I believe that women make a shift in their way of thinking when they approach the years, when they get close to 30 years of age. Mother Nature, biological clocks start ticking, and at that point they said, okay, I've gone to university, I started my career, is this a good time now to start a family? So now they put a lot of pressure on most of the men that they meet, because before it was fun to have sex with them, now they just want to find a partner. They want to find the father for their children. Not all of them, obviously, but at that time, for a woman, it's very crucial because they're not going to be fertile forever. There's a lot of risk of getting pregnant when you're 40 years and higher. You don't know the quality of your ovums anymore and if you're going to put your future child's health in danger. So you want to have children when you're younger, but you don't. Women don't want to have them when they're 20 anymore. They want to focus on their education so that they can be more stable in terms of economically stable in the future. So for women, It's just that there is a shift in their behavior to start a family. For men, they don't have that pressure. They can be a father at 50. They can be a father at 60. It's not a big issue for them. They're not the ones that's going to go through 9 months of pregnancy. And most of the time, guys are not always the person that's there to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning for the breastfeeding. So it's not like the guys don't have to mature or to face that big responsibility as early as women do. So the sexual value of men, is it affected? I don't think that it's affected, but I would not put a lower sexual value. I would just put it a different interest now in the woman's sexuality.
Now, do you think that in the grand scheme of things, the way sexual economics are now, do you think there will be an even greater shift in the future as things change? Or do you think basically, you know, humans are humans and it's going to come down to the same focal point anyway?
I believe the sexual evolution is going to change. Sometimes it does a pendulum where it comes back on itself, where family values goes more and more. But if you can look at the census, you look at common law being more of a factor, so religion is taking a backdoor a lot more. People are living together more. They're having children, and they're still having children, but a lot less because it's more expensive to have a family now. In terms of sexual freedom, who knows? Maybe we're going to see a lot more movement, maybe shorter relationships because careers are changing. The world is starting to be a smaller place. When you start dating, you don't date in your little village anymore, going to church or going to school. You have internet that gives you access to thousands of people at the at your fingertips. I think that we're going to see a lot more universal dating, where it's going to shrink down the world for everybody. So you're going to have a lot more marriage of multi-race marriage, or just hooking up for a few years and then changing on to something else. I see an evolution mostly on not what they're going to do, but who they're going to do it with. People are less and less racist, which is a good thing. They travel more. I think that people are going to put down their roots at different places, but it's not going to be roots that are going to, until death do us part, tie you down forever. You know, I think that people are going to be learning different relationships. And you know how you meet somebody, you learn different skills with different people. I think that people are going to be able to hook up for 10, 15 years and then change relationships and recreate themselves. I just see good things happening. It's just going to be more difficult if there's children involved.
That's definitely a very positive spin to have on it, especially because so many people think the world is going to hell in a handbasket. So it's a good way to look at it. And I just wanted to ask you as well, with regards to what's happening now and, you know, in the next 5 to 7 years, do you have any piece of advice for both men and women as to how they handle themselves in regards to sexual economics?
In terms of sexual economics, if you're going to want to stay into a relationship, try to learn the person before you go and have sex with them. And what I mean is try to find out if that person can be a good friend before she can be the best sexual play partner for you. It's nice to have a good chemistry in terms of physical chemistry with the person, but sex usually lasts like 1 hour a day. Mm-hmm. And after that, there's many more hours to hang out with that person. So the closeness that you need to develop with that person, the intimacy, does not always have to be sexual. You need to find a good friend that you can fall in love with and have great sex with. So it's not just sexual. Like, try to find a connection with that person before, and then your chances of a longer, happier relationships are going to be increased.
Dr. Renee, thank you so much for your time on this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was clinical sexologist Dr. Renée Lacteau. For more information and tips, make sure to go to her website, drsexology.com.
Bring on the
remix.
United State of Pop on The Kelly Alexander Show. Well, a big thank you going out to my guests, Ariane de Bonvoisin, Emily, and Dr. Renée Lacteau. Here is your inspirational quote of the week, this time from Winston Churchill. Success is stumbling from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. Now, next week on the show, we're going to speak with the founder of The Running Room, John Stanton. He has a lot to say about taking care of yourself through exercise and how he got his business to be a leading company in Canada and how it's now expanding beyond Canada's borders. Don't forget to check us out on our Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show, also on Twitter, at K Alexander Show, and keep checking our website, kellyalexandershow.com. We've got lots of blogs and video and all that sort of great stuff to check out on our website, so make sure you check it out. If you have any comments or questions, very simple, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.